Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another season of Movie Rob Minute. Well, we have reached the 11th season, and this season I decided to do something a little bit different in the endeavor that I've been doing for the last 10 seasons. So for season 11, I will be bringing you the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers from 2001, 5 minutes at a time. I decided that because this entire miniseries is 10 hours and 26 minutes, which comes out to 626 minutes, and if you divide that by minutes, if I was doing that day by day, it would take me almost 21 months to do that. So that's nearly 2 years of time. I have the stamina to do that, but I don't know if you all will have the stamina to listen to a podcast that would go on for that long. So I decided that this season I'm going to be doing something similar to what I did in season 9. I'm going to be recording episodes 5 minutes of screen time at a time. But yet, there's more. Because this season, the way that the miniseries is set up, so each of the 10 episodes, the 10 parts of Band of Brothers, has an intro section and an outro section. So the intro section deals with a lot of the talking head interviews with the men of Easy Company, which we don't know who they are until the end, in order to not give away spoilers of who of the men survived, not just the war, but survived all the way till the making of this miniseries, which they filmed in approximately 2001. And they also have the show intro, which is also included in that. And then obviously you have the credits at the end of the 10 parts. So what I decided to do is I'm going to be doing 19 interviews, and the interviews will be the first and last episode of each of these 10 parts. So the reason I say 19 is because the finale, obviously I'm not going to be doing an interview. The finale will be the typical way that I always do my finale. Each movie that I've recorded over the last 10 seasons, and now obviously the 11th. The 5 minutes of screen time is going to be split up among the minutes that are left over. So I'm basically going to be cutting out the bookends of each of the 10 parts of this miniseries. Each of those parts of I guess you could say the meat or the chunk of action that happens between the characters, that's what I'm splitting up 5 minutes at a time. So I have a lot of guests that are scheduled. This season, obviously, the episodes, just like in season 9, are going to be slightly longer because we're dealing with talking about 5 minutes of screen time instead of just 1 minute of screen time. The assumption is that each episode will be approximately an hour long. Obviously, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more. The interviews that I'm going to be presenting you with are with people who are somehow connected to the story of Band of Brothers, whether it's the men of Easy Company, whether it's the miniseries, whether it's possible people that worked behind the scenes. Sometimes some of the people will be World War II historians. Some of them will be people who do reenactments and do tours that are connected to Band of Brothers. So I have a lot for you to be listening to over the next 136 episodes. That's the tally of how it comes out. I will approximately be finishing this on July 4th, 2026, which obviously is the 250th anniversary of America. And it is actually also, it will be 5 years to the day since I started my podcast, which started on July 4th, 2001 for The Great Escape. So for anyone who's not familiar, Movies by Minute, it's a crazy way to look at movies where we break down movies 1 minute at a time, and each episode we talk about 1 minute of screen time. There is a community of hundreds of people probably who have been doing podcasts for the last 10, 15 years. Where they've been doing this with some of the most popular and famous movies. Some people have done some of their favorite movies, which aren't necessarily the most popular ones, but it gives us all a chance to dive deep into these movies and get more information about what it is that's going on. Obviously, the people who started this phenomena are Pete and Alex of the Star Wars Minute, which they've been going strong talking about Star Wars in this very unique way. And without them, most of us who are in the Movies by Minute community would not have started doing what we're doing and would not have succeeded without the work from Pete and Alex. So I want to thank them. I want to thank the entire Movies by Minute community, which have been so helpful to me over my last 10 plus seasons, because obviously I've already started recording for this season. I've made a lot of friends over the years from that community, and they're a lot of helpful people, and they're fun to discuss movies with, and I always enjoy having them on my show. Other thanks, I want to once again thank David Brook for doing the musical interludes for both the intro and outro to each of these episodes. So thank you, David. I hope that I've done you justice with the way that I've been set, what I've set up the intros and outros for this particular season. I want to obviously thank my behind-the-scenes co-producer, Jay Cluett of the Deep Blue Sea Pod, who has encouraged me along the entire way, even before the beginning of this. I know that he hates mention of him, but the bottom line is that he's not on today's episode, so I can talk as much about him as I want and thank him as much as I want, because he's only going to be back tomorrow. Instead of Jay taking first guest seat like he has always done throughout every other season, what we decided this season to do is he is going to be taking the guest seat for each of the first episodes of each of the 10 parts after dealing with the interviews. So today I'm going to have an interview. Just to let everyone know, the segments that we're going to be doing on the show this season are Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. We will have a day of World War II movie trivia, where I will test my guests' knowledge of World War II movies. Then we will have a segment called Oh Brother, where we will talk about favorite brothers in movies, top five favorite brothers. And every day we will have a daily game that's Name That World War II Movie, where I will randomly give hints and clues to a particular World War II movie, and my guests will have to try and guess it. Today, we will be starting off with a great guest. I have George Luz Jr., who will be joining me. He is the son of one of the Band of Brothers, of George Luz Sr., who is predominantly featured in this miniseries, and we're going to have a great conversation about his father, about the men, and about everything about Band of Brothers. So sit back, enjoy. Today, for the first episode of Season 11, here's my discussion with George Luz Jr. Enjoy. Well, for this first interview today, I'm starting with the big guns. I'm starting with the man himself, George Luz Jr., the son of George Luz, who is predominantly featured in the entire series, also in the book. He's played by Rick Gomez in the miniseries. So welcome back to the show, George, for yet another season. This time it's a season focusing on you, or on your family story, as well as everyone else's.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on, Rob, and I appreciate the opportunity to share the stories of my dad and the men he served with.
Yeah. That's what we're all here for. That's what people are going to be coming and listening to all 136 episodes of this season, to hear about the story of Easy Company, of the you know, the men of the 506. Why don't we start from the beginning? Who was your father? Who was he before he got to Tacoma?
Well, hey, my dad was born in June 17th, 1921, in Fall River, Massachusetts. His parents were immigrants from the Azorean island of San Miguel. And not soon after that, they moved to a little town in Rhode Island called West Warwick, where there were more opportunities for my grandfather to work. And so my dad, that's where he grew up predominantly. He lived through the Depression, like most people of that age. And so he had some really colorful jobs as a kid, because everyone was always trying to do something to generate money to supply for the household to feed each other. And so my dad was a shoeshine boy. And one of the more colorful jobs he had was he was a signboard. So back in the day, in a little town we lived in on the main street, especially on Fridays or Saturdays or Sundays, they would have these pieces of plywood with advertisements on it. And people would walk up and down the street with pieces of plywood with advertising on the front and the back. So that was one of the crazy jobs my dad had as a kid growing up, was that, along with, because back in the day they didn't have refrigerators, they had ice boxes. He would carry ice to people's houses up 2, 3 flights of stairs and put ice in their ice boxes. So they were tough back then, growing up in the Depression, and then the war broke out, and my dad made it till the 11th grade. After the 11th grade, he quit school, and after that, he joined the military and began. He signed up in Providence, and I think he ended up in Fort Devens,
Okay, but
Massachusetts.
if your father was born in 1921, so it means he was already 21 years old
That's
when the
correct.
war broke out.
That's correct.
So he wasn't an 18-year-old who joined up after Pearl Harbor. I mean, he's he was a little bit older. When
That's correct. Yeah.
did he join up because of Pearl Harbor or?
I'm not sure exactly why he joined, but so he joined actually in 1942
Okay.
is when he signed up. Yeah, 1942 in July, he reported to Camp Tocowa. So I guess it was about a year that had gone by before he decided what direction to go in. And my dad, they talk about joining the airborne and
For $50 more.
for $50 more. And when you look at that, some guys were saying in the movie illustrated it, there was some article in Reader's Digest and on how it was to join the airborne. And well, my dad didn't find the Reader's Digest, but he did see where it was $50 more a month. So that's why he joined the airborne, strictly for the extra money, because as a kid growing up during the Depression, that was a lot of money.
Do you know how much it would be based on inflation today? Do you have any idea?
Well, I didn't go to school for business, that's for sure, so I couldn't tell you.
Okay, no, just to give you an idea, it's about $1,000 today.
Oh, it is.
So, I
Wow.
mean, again, that's a significant sum to be getting an extra
Yeah.
$1,000 a month.
I
So,
know. Yeah, you could send that home to your
because
family.
right, because from our perspective today, $50 isn't that much to add to it, but. When you think if someone were to say, "Here, I'll give you an extra $1,000 if you start jumping out of planes," maybe it's a rethink a few things.
Yeah, because probably bread was like 5 cents or something.
Probably, yeah.
Bread was probably 5 cents, and a pack of
Yes.
cigarettes was probably 10 cents. So much different environment.
That's true. That's true. Okay, so your father got to Tocowa.
Yeah. So, they trained in Tocowa until about December. And then in December, they made that march from Tocowa to Atlanta. There was that article in Reader's Digest that Colonel Sink had read, that the Japanese had marched 100 miles in 72 hours or something like that. So he felt as though his men could do better, and they did. So they
And they did.
marched all the way from Tocowa to Atlanta, and they covered 118 miles in 75 hours.
Right. I
And
remember reading about it in the book. It does mention that.
So that was quite a feat. And actually, I was just in Atlanta last week, and I got a chance to talk with some folks about, and there's a college there too. It might have been I think it was a college at Oglethorpe College, where I think the night before they marched right into Atlanta, the city proper, they spent the night there, if my understanding is correct.
Oh well. Okay, and my assumption is that like we see in the miniseries, and like anyone who reads the book notices, the time in Tocowa was when the men became more solidified as friends. So who were your father's closest friends during that time? Do you have any recollection?
Well, as time went on, I could say that I think Frank Ricconi was probably my dad's, I hate to say closest buddy, but if you look at the pictures after the war, the reunion photos, There's a lot of photos of my dad and Frank together within little groupings. And so, as the years progressed, my dad was buddies with all of the guys. And so, but my dad was in first platoon, and there was a distinction, your first platoon guys and second platoon guys and third platoon guys. There were three different platoons. So
Right,
there
because
wasn't a lot of, back and forth.
Winters was the second lieutenant. He was the platoon commander of the second platoon, wasn't he?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
I think I recall hearing that. Okay. All right, and so they finished Tekoa, and then they eventually got shipped off to England.
On
In September 43, right.
September 43 at Camp Shanks. Camp Shanks, New York. It's interesting. I went to Camp Shanks last year. A dear friend of mine, Maureen, and her husband, who live in that area, came on one of my tours with Steve Ambrose Historical Tours, and told me where they were from. So on one of my journeys, I stopped by, and they gave me a great tour of Camp Shanks, what remains there of the camp, and then there's a path that goes from Camp Shanks down to Piedmont Pier. Where they got on the ferry, which brought them to closer to the ocean in the city, and then they got on a troop ship and then went across to Liverpool, England. I think it was 10, 12, 14-day cruise. After that, my father never wanted to go on a ship again.
Yes, the trip on the was the San Maria was the descriptions are not something that you really want to have to experience. It's enough experiencing just reading it or just watching, in the miniseries we get maybe 3 minutes of the stories of what's going on there, but you see how cramped it is. So, yeah.
Then and my mother wanted to go on a cruise, later in life, but my dad was he didn't want to hear it. So
Really?
dad, these are not troop ships. These are
That's
not
right.
troop ships. These are
You'd
cruise ships.
think that he would want that he would know that a cruise ship will be a little better, but okay, happens. All right. So obviously, what was your father the quote unquote class clown as shown in the miniseries?
Well, all of the guys were funny, and I was able to come across that as the years went on, being around the guys as much. They all had a great sense of humor. Walter Gordon, for example, had an amazing sense of humor. He was fantastic. And, Garnier and Heffron and et cetera, Frank Procconi. But I guess my dad was a little unique in a way, and he certainly was the company comedian. So, and it was interesting the way they kind of portrayed him on that. In the miniseries.
Did he really do voices and imitations of different commanders and stuff like that? Did you, or is that just poetic license?
Well, I know, I think that certainly did happen. That certainly did happen in the series, in the book, and in real life. And actually, I met Captain Sobel's son Michael. I
Oh,
never
really?
met Captain Sobel, but I met his son Michael. Yeah. He came to the reunion in Phoenix in 2002, which was the year after the premiere. And yeah, it was really great to meet him. And I remember when he came in, came to the reunion. So it was in Phoenix, and it's we were outside in the courtyard area. And when I saw him, I recognized him, and I brought him right over to Bill Wingate, because I know Wingate had known his dad quite well, and didn't have the adversarial position that other guys did. So brought him over to Bill and said, "Hey, I want to introduce you to Bill Wingate." So he sat with Bill and talked with him for a period of time, and then he went from each and every guy that would, pass him off to this one and that one and this one and that. So throughout the entire afternoon, he had a wonderful time of connecting with these guys who served with his dad and had great conversations. And that evening, Bill Garnier, who was running the reunions at the time, wanted Michael to tell the group at the final banquet about his dad. And so we got a much different picture of how he interpreted his dad. So it was very interesting to hear that his dad was just a regular guy, like everybody else. And he said he was quite funny. He was the life of the party in many cases. So it was really interesting to hear that. And I'm sure at the end of that weekend, you know, Michael probably came in very apprehensive, but he walked away without that weight on his shoulders any longer.
Wow. That's amazing. Because I know in the book it talks about what happened to Sobel afterwards, you know, and I think, you know, it's somewhat tragic, everything that happened with him, the way that it's explained there, you know, that I'm pretty sure that he, if I remember correctly, he got divorced and he was estranged from his family. And then in the end, he committed suicide. So,
yeah, he attempted suicide, and I don't know if that killed him.
That's right. He attempted
Yeah,
it.
he attempted suicide. So, you know, you wonder, looking at from the prism of today, you know, with the amount of suicides of our soldiers in the, today, you wonder if that's kind of what a little bit what he suffered was the PTSD from combat fatigue, as they called it back in the day. You know, you wonder if he suffered some sort of combat fatigue to one degree or another that drove him to that point.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, the book describes it perfectly that without the way that Sobel trained them, it's possible that the men would not have been as close. You know, his method of training both saved a lot of lives because they all were completely physically fit from all the crazy things that he did. You know, so, but, you know, you still had the animosity at the time for the way that it was being done. You know, I think you could probably say that he was a great instructor, but not necessarily a good leader. I think that's probably the way that you can, you know, so yeah, it's.
No, I agree. And to a man, the men all credit him with that feature, that ability to bring everybody together.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Very interesting. Did Michael ever show up again?
No, he never did. He never did. He came up to that one. I'm not surprised. You know, not surprised. Interesting thing is, you know, we get together every year as back in, I think about 2012, 2011, somewhere in that time frame. The men decided that they were no longer able to continue with the reunions as they were set up at that point. And so the men would always have their meeting on Saturday afternoon. So we would all be hanging around in the lobby or in the hospitality waiting for them to come out, because then they would come out and say, next year the reunion is going to be at, and they would tell us what city it is. So we would all be, you know, we would all be saying, hey, I wonder what city it's going to be this year, next year. So this particular year, they came out and told us that they were no longer going to be able to do it because they were all getting older.
Right. So, well, if it was 2012, then they were all in their 90s by that point. The few that were left.
Yeah. Well, there was still quite a few left at that point. But so then they said, so kids, now it's your responsibility to take over. So then we said, okay. So then we ended up having a meeting. So kind of a quick meeting. We all of us kids, a dozen of us, you know, went into one of our, actually my wife had gotten us a suite. We're all sitting in the suite and talking and then processing the situation, and just said, okay, next year's reunion. Scotty Gordon said, Walter Gordon's son, hey, let's have it in Louisiana. So it's like, okay, cool. All right. So the following year, we hit the ground running. It was in Louisiana. The following year from there, Gary Carson said, okay, next year, let's do Seattle. And then after that, Hack Hansen's daughter said, let's do Chicago. And then Chris Langlois said, "Hey, let's do Atlanta." And it's continued since then. So we have continued that stretch even through the pandemic.
Wow.
And I must credit several of the kids, Chris Langlois, Tracy Compton, and the late Marianne Malarkey, along with a few others, for keeping that string alive during COVID, because they did have a reunion in Dallas during that. So it has been continuous since 1946 that
Wow,
they have
that's
gotten
amazing.
together. And this past year, the reunion was in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So we've continued that string of reunions, and we encourage the sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters and just friends of Easy Company to keep it together, keep their string alive, and continue to honor their legacy.
Wow. How many on average still show up at the at you know of the descendants show up at these yearly meetings?
Well, sometimes it depends on where it is. If it's
Yeah,
on
of
the West
course.
Coast, East Coast,
Yeah.
middle of the country, usually we get about 30, 35 people, and then within that you probably get 10 or 12, maybe sometimes 15 kids come, and with their spouses and things like that. And so we're always encouraging kids. Actually, I just had an event in Gettysburg, and I got a chance to see Millie Zimmerman, who is in her 90s. Her husband, Hank Zimmerman, was in the company. He came in right before Bastogne,
Oh, wow.
and I got a chance to see Millie. And then there's a lot of moving parts, and it's great. And we're always encouraging kids, grandkids and such. If they want to connect, they can certainly come to our reunions, and we have a great time reminiscing. I think on this last trip, Tracy Compton brought all kinds of really cool things from her dad, is his little notebook and things like that, and all kinds of paperwork. So every year, somebody brings some stuff that we can kind of look at, little nuggets of information, which are really cool to take that trip down memory lane.
Yeah, wow. Sounds amazing. Really does. As you said, they started reunions in 1946, and then so how did Ambrose come across the story? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think what happened there, Steve Ambrose had written quite a few books, history books and the like. And I think Winters, I don't know if he had a direct connection with Stephen or he just knew of Stephen. So, Dick had collected everything or kept everything that he was given and was a very good organizer. And had letters and all kinds of the correspondence that was going back and forth within the company for all those years. And he had it all on file, so to speak. And he reached out to Stephen to come to a reunion in New Orleans. Stephen was from that area anyway. So it was in 1988 that the reunion was held in New Orleans at the Modigliani Hotel. And Stephen and his assistant, Ron Drez, showed up at the hotel, went to the front desk and said, "Hey, there's an airborne group here. Where are they? What room number?" And I think the lady said something like, "Just hit number six. When you get to six, just listen for the roar. And then just follow the noise and you'll find the room." So they showed up at the reunion and they had a discussion. And one of the humorous things was, so Steve comes in and introduces himself, and then Ron comes is also with him, and he introduces himself and says, "I'm a Marine," and they booed and hissed him, because he's a Marine and they were Army. So that was kind of funny. That was kind of funny. But Ron's a heck of a nice guy. So terrific guy.
Wait, who?
And
You have to tell me who Ron is.
oh, Ron Drez.
Ah, okay.
Ron Drez. And so he was kind of, I think he was kind of like Steve's assistant or protege or confidant. I'm not sure exactly, but so anyway, yeah, that was funny. And Ron is still alive to this day, and he's still doing tours.
Oh,
He
wow.
still does tours with Stephen Ambrose Tours, and he's still on a speaking, he still does speaking engagements as well. You have vast knowledge of history. And so anyway, at that particular reunion, what happened was he came in, he sat down with the guys, and they all kind of talked. And you know, after that particular day or so, or day and a half, they got back home, and the conversations continued. And Stephen just felt that based on, you know, what they had, there certainly could be a book there. So what Ambrose did was he connected with several guys in person, and then he came up with a letter that people could fill in the blanks, so to speak, a survey of sorts. And they sent those out. But he interviewed, I know he interviewed Walter Gordon in person. I know he interviewed Walter Gordon, I think Lipton, naturally Winters, and maybe one or two others in person. And then the other guys also all got the surveys. And then when the information would come back, Steve would work with Dick, and they would kind of cover the ground, and they would craft, you know, Stephen would craft the story, and then Dick would make sure it was, you know, as close to reality as humanly possible. So that's how the book came out. And the book came out. Oh, and the one thing, my sister Lana deserves a lot of credit because she's the one who encouraged my father to fill out the survey. Because my dad really wasn't going to fill out a survey. He wasn't that concerned about it. He just said, "Yeah, I'm not really worried. There's enough stories in there. I'm sure I'll get my name. My name will pop up somewhere along the way." But my sister is the one that deserves the credit to make sure that he got in there. So she's my sister Lana.
Right.
She's my
Oh,
older sister.
wow. How long was the process of writing the book? Do you have any idea how long it took Ambrose
Yeah, so
and Winters?
it began in '98. Yeah, it began in '98,
No, it
and
couldn't have. Wait, the book began in 98?
well, that initial meeting began in '98. I mean, sorry, '88.
88. Right. I
Yeah,
was.
yeah.
That's what I know, because I knew that in the late 90s, that's already the next
Yeah,
portion of
no,
the
I
book
get
to
it.
talk about.
Yeah,
But
so
88.
the initial meeting was in 1988. And then in 1992 is when the book came out. They had the book opening in Louisiana at the Eisenhower Center. And so it was really cool. And I've got this great letter from Winters, who he sent out to all the men, just talking about, yeah, he referenced it like, "Hey, it was a month ago. We were all together and it was great. And 19 of the original Company E Band of Brothers recall it stories about June 5th and June 6th of 1944." He went on to say Steve was happy enough to send me a copy of this tape. And so the cool thing is, I think all of the men got a copy of that particular tape.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so it's really neat to listen to all of the guys. So how it began was,
Do you have a copy of that? Do you have your father's copy of it?
oh
Or
yeah. Yeah.
oh, wow.
And actually I use quite a bit of that when I make my Band of Brothers presentation lectures. Because it's the men in their own words. So for me, you know, I could just repeat things and stuff like that, but people really do get a enjoy it much better when they hear it come right out of their own mouth.
Again,
So
that's something they do in the miniseries also, but we'll get there.
yeah, so that's the cool thing about it. But so anyway, yeah, so that's how it happened. So the book comes out in 92, and you know, my dad comes home with several books, and you know, we all have our copy. So it was really neat. And, it's just a great testament to Winters, Ambrose, all of the guys, and the complete story that was told.
Oh wow. And I mean, was we'll revisit the same question in the next when we get to the mini series, but were the men happy with where or let's put it this way, were all of the men happy with the way the book portrayed them, or were there some of them that I don't know, were maybe a little bitter about things that without using names.
Yeah. Well, no, I think most of the men overall were pretty happy about it. One of the challenges is, there were 360 guys or so that went through the unit from the beginning to the very end, through killed in action and wounded and things like that. And, you can never write a book with 360
No, of
characters.
course not. Of course not.
And one thing I learned, I saw a letter in my dad's letters. That Ambrose had mentioned, he said, you can't, when you write a book, when you are a writer, you have to be cognizant of the fact that not every person is going to be happy with what you wrote.
Yeah, of course.
So you got to have thick skin as far as that goes. And I'm sure there were some things along the way that some guys were a little disappointed about, or maybe they didn't get, oh, it's like, hey, gee whiz, I was standing right next to that guy the whole time. Why did his name end up in it and mine didn't? So,
No, but some they might also say, well, that was inaccurate. I was the one who did this, not that guy. That type of thing might have also happened.
I think of some of that happened during the filming of the series.
Yeah, okay, right. That
Yeah.
we'll get to when we start talking about the series. Right. So but you're saying overall your father was quite pleased with the way that the book portrayed him and the men.
Yeah, I think he was very proud of the fact that, they told their story. And but what's interesting is, I was talking to somebody recently about there's a book called Rendezvous with Destiny, and that was the first airborne book I think that came out. It was like 1947. And on page 751, I remember my dad showing me there's this little paragraph that included my father's name
Oh,
and
wow.
is something that referenced Webster, Dave Webster, who was in the unit. And that was my first encounter that, my dad was in kind of World War II, and gee whiz, my dad's in a book about World War II. So this was kind of the second thing, and naturally this one I was able to understand it a lot more. And it was just kind of cool because these were all guys that I knew. I grew up around these guys. So I was very fortunate to not only grow up around these guys, but to read a little bit more about them when they served in World War II.
Right. Now, was your father always open up to you and everyone about everything that he went through?
Yeah,
Or
he
I mean,
certainly
again,
was.
with the men, obviously, because based on I mean, my presumption from the way you were talking before is that there were sessions where it was just the men talking, where their families were not part of the discussion, and then part of it was with the families. So.
Especially at the reunions and things like that, the men would all go in the hospitality and the, I've got all kinds of pictures of, the men sitting over here and the women sitting over here, and the men are telling the war stories and the wives are saying, we should be going doing some. There's got to be something to see other than the inside of this hospitality suite. So, but anyway, yeah. So the men would certainly have their time when they would be with their buddies and stuff like that. So. And the wives. But now back to your point, my dad never would shy away from a question. But he didn't go walking down the street boasting his airborne hat, that
No,
you didn't have.
but I'm talking about when he discussed it with you and
Oh,
your
with me
family members
personally,
and stuff like
yeah.
that. Because again,
No.
we all know that there are a lot of veterans even now not just veterans from World War II, where, they didn't discuss things with their families. It was too traumatic for them to discuss it. So, obviously the fact that the men of Easy were getting together, having these reunions, they were able to discuss it. I recall that the last time you and I spoke, when we did Saving Private Ryan, you mentioned the fact that they would even bring men from other units to come to the reunion sometimes, so that these men had people to talk to that understood what they went through.
My dad never refrained from any questions that I had. I just wish I was a little bit more inquisitive. I have more questions now than before. But my dad, yeah, he always, when the newspapers would reach out to him or something like that, to do interviews and things like that. I've got all kinds of little articles about him talking about whether it's Veterans Day or the Battle of the Bulge or D-Day and things like that. Yeah, he didn't seem to suffer any PTSD or anything like that. Not that he didn't, but I've got a couple of tapes of my dad, a video of my dad. This guy, Tom Kelly, who captured the only video of my father, which is really cool. And yeah, it's the only video he had found my dad. This was before the series came out. At the Rhode Island Army National Guard event they had. And so my dad was there and he just kind of was looking for veterans to talk with and he bumped into my father. So my dad is just talking with him about, he's asking him questions and in the background you can hear all this machine gun fire. And my dad didn't flinch a bit. So he didn't seem to be a problem. He didn't seem, even with the machine gun fire in the background, he didn't flinch a bit. So.
That's amazing. What did your I know the miniseries describes it a little bit, but like, okay, your father, before we get to the miniseries, let's talk a little more about your father. Okay, he came home from the war. Spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen the miniseries. George Luz makes it home, thankfully, because then we wouldn't be having this conversation with his son. So what's your father's story from, when he got home from Europe?
Well, yeah, so he just got back home and tried to reacclimate and one of his best buddies, Tony, my dad was one of 10 and Tony was one of 12. So anyway, one of his best buddies, Tony, had a bunch of sisters and my mom and dad were about 5 years apart age-wise. So when he got back from the war, now my dad is 24. He's 24 now. So Tony's sisters, he's got a bunch of sisters that are all a bit older. So he, one of them was 19. And so he noticed one of Tony's sisters that was kind of neat. And they ended up falling in love and getting married. So he got married in, I think it was 1948. He got married and then he started working. He worked in the lace weaving business. Back in the day, that was a big business in Rhode Island, lace weaving. So, and then when you were a certified lace weaver, you made good money. So my dad did that for several years until lace weaving moved to the South. So then he worked for a Davisville Naval Air Station. And so he worked for the government. And he did that for a while. And then after that closed, he's 0 for 2. And then after that, he worked for a guy who built homes and residential homes and did that for quite a while. And then that guy, Paul, he ended up getting a job at the state. So he said to my dad, "Hey, I can get you a job at the state." So he got my job at the state. And then my dad, for the last 12 years, I think, or 10 years, whatever it was, he worked for the state of Rhode Island in the maintenance division. So that's what he did in his life as a career working wise.
It's interesting types of jobs that he did over the years and stuff like that. But it shows that he wasn't afraid to work with his hands.
No, that's good. He was very handy. And it's kind of humorous in the series. They talk about he was a handyman from Providence. He was a handy guy, but he wasn't a handyman. A handyman is, well, a handyman today could probably make six figures, right? A handyman today in the United States, that is, because most people don't even know how to put a curtain rod up.
Yeah, that I'm one of those people. It drives my wife nuts, but I always say to her that what would she rather, that I try and make a bigger mess of things or getting someone who actually knows what they're doing? So
That's funny.
yeah. All right. And when did your father pass away? Was it before they started production on the miniseries, or were they already in the middle of it?
Well, I don't know exactly when it started production. I don't think so, but there was conversation that something was going on as far as the book.
Right, because I remember when we talked about Saving Private Ryan, I vaguely recall that you said that you saw Saving Private Ryan with your father. So it means in
That's correct, yeah.
98 he was still around. That much I remember.
Yeah, October 15th is when my dad was killed, because he was killed in an industrial accident.
Right.
He
Ah, that's right. I
was actually
remember
still
that's
working. So, but yeah, so we had gone to Saving Private Ryan, and so there was conversations prior to that, because what had happened was when Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, they bought the rights to Saving Private, Band of Brothers and Citizen Soldier, another Steve Ambrose book. And in both of those books, there's a reference to the Nyland family, who lost several of their family members during the war. And so it's really the Nyland family,
Not the Ryan family.
not the Ryan family. It
Yes.
wouldn't have sounded right, Saving Fritz Nyland.
No,
So
no,
wouldn't
no.
have sounded right.
Skip Muck was the guy who knew Nyland.
That's right. Yeah. Skip Muck. Yeah, he was buddies. They were buddies, and there's a reference to them. There's a reference to them in there's a reference to that connection in Band of Brothers when they're talking about swimming the Niagara. It doesn't it didn't I don't think it I'm trying to think if it says it, but what happened was when he swam the Niagara, Fritz was in a canoe right next to him as he was traversing the from one side of the river to the other side of the river. You know how it is. If the current is whatever the current is, you're following the current, but he was doing his best to get across. But Fritz was in a canoe next to him. So if he got in a real jam, he could just grab the canoe. But anyway, that's a relationship that Fritz Nyland had with Skip. And then but yeah, so there were conversations that there was something going on, and not long after that is, after that came out was when and my dad had passed away when HBO came calling.
Wow. What do you know about the production of, of the miniseries itself?
Well, Dick Winters did a great job, because my dad had passed away in 98. And then after that, things started to progress. And he did everything he could to make sure that my mother received every scrap of paper, every informational thing regarding the series, so that she would be, in tune to what's going on. It was, my dad might have been gone, but the men looked at the widows and wanted to make sure that they were taken care of too. In a sense of always being kept in the loop, because back to the reunion, several of the widows, after if their husband passed away, several of the widows continued to go to reunions. And so the men felt it was their responsibility to make sure that they took care of their buddy's, widow. So, and that was the case with Winters and my mom, and I'm sure other widows as well. So yeah, so he kept my mom and all the paperwork that was coming to him, he made sure he made a copy and sent it to my mom so she was up to speed. We were up to speed on everything that was going on with the filming. Pay attention to this. You're going to see some interesting information. And then when Eric Jenderson called my mother's house, I just happened to be there that night. It was Wednesday, which is Prince Spaghetti Day in New England. And it's laundry day too. I usually do my laundry on Wednesdays. So my mother was doing my laundry. So she always did my laundry. But so I was there that night, the phone rang, and it was Eric Jenderson from HBO. And I had a very brief conversation with him, and then I handed him over to my mother. And then she had a longer conversation with him and just kind of described a little bit about who my dad was and things like that. So it was great that that was the initial phone call that they had had, and that somebody was going to be playing my dad and stuff like that. So that was really, really cool. And
Well,
we really didn't have any idea, how much my dad would be in this thing. So
okay, so you spoke with Eric, and you spoke with Eric, your mother spoke with Eric, and then the show was made. Did you meet Rick Gomez beforehand?
yeah, I was very fortunate when HBO was getting ready to, launch the kickoff of this whole thing. It was already in production. And the 2000 reunion, there were three important things that were going to happen. One of them was Easy Company was going to have their reunion in New Orleans. The second thing was the opening of the D-Day Museum. And the third thing that was going to happen was Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg were going to announce where and when the world premiere of the Band of Brothers was going to be. So that was really cool. So that was in 2000. And so that was really neat. And then they said, and during that meeting, actually, during that reunion, HBO sent several of their folks from the series, some of the directors and things like that, along with Ivan. And there was a guy named Joe Hobbs. Joe was the main costume guy, English guy. And these English people, when they start talking, you gravitate toward them because they talk funny. But they always seem to be, they appear to be very intelligent, which they are. And they speak much nicer than we speak. So Hobbs was a great, great guy. And I remember asking him, I said, "Hey, Joe," because he was the costume guy. I says, "Can I get a pair of those jump boots?" And he said, "George, if you come over on your own steam to the set, I'll give you a pair." So I says, "Okay." So that was in June. So we set it up in August, I think it was. So in August, my wife and I went to the set. And so Joe picked us up at the airport, brought us to our hotel. We spent a couple of days at the Savoy in London. He brought some of the actors over. He brought the kid who played my dad, Rick Gomez, James Matteo, and then one other. For some reason, I can't remember who that third one was. To the hotel, we had dinner together. It was great. And then the following couple of days, we went to the set. And spent a couple of days at the set, got a chance to meet all of the actors who were playing guys that I knew. It was really cool.
Oh, wow.
Now, I wasn't Luz, but I was Luz's kid. And I don't want to say they were looking forward to seeing me, but I was looking forward to seeing these kids because I knew the guys that they were playing. And it was really, really great to see the set, to see the guys, the actors. To see the environment, to see what goes involved in putting together something that like that. One of the other things that was very interesting too about these actors was this wasn't just any ordinary role. These guys took this very, very seriously, and they were immersed in it like no other role they probably have ever played. And it was cool because so Joe was, bringing us around and. I remember going to the area where they had their trailers. So they all have a trailer. And all of the actors have a trailer. Not all of them, but many of them. And then they had this other thing. It was a big tent, like a military tent. And in the tent, it was like a ping pong table, and it was all kinds of the clothes that they changed into. And that was where they hung out. They hung out most of the times in that little rec area. They didn't hang out sitting in their trailer with their feet up. They hung out when they had time to hang out, they hung out there, playing ping pong or whatever it was, and just shooting the breeze, and then building those relationships just like the guys in the unit did. So it was really cool to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sounds like these they knew that they were supposed to be doing something like that, that they I guess they felt it from the idea of having to play these men that's the way to do it. Wow.
Yeah,
That's
and then all of a sudden they turn into, and then naturally, and I'm sure they do this with every set, is you're no longer James Matteo, you're Frank Bocconi. Or you're no longer Rick Gomez, you're George Law. So that's, that was the, they worked on that and worked on that. And you've heard the stories about the boot camp that Captain Dye, Dale Dye, had put them through, and how important that was. And that was just great stuff. And I look at the actors, they did such a great job. Great ambassadors for the men that they portrayed. Not only the men that they portrayed, but for veterans in general, they're just great ambassadors. And I'm just proud of all of them. And so many of them continue to this day to wear that as a sense of pride that they were involved in Band of Brothers.
So I've heard that. I haven't had a chance yet to talk to any of the actors, but I'm hoping to. I'm hoping to find ways to get in touch with them and convince them that they should tell me stories.
Yeah, well, they've all got such great stories. And there's so much tape on those guys out there, too.
It's
Well,
true.
they all got agents.
That's true. Yeah.
They all got agents.
So the question is did you get your boots?
Yeah, so I did get the boots. And it was funny because when my wife and I got to the set, we got to the set and we just kind of get set up. And then Joe goes over, he grabs a pair of boots and he gives them to me. And I said, "Oh, whose boots were these?" And he said, "Oh, those were Tom Hanks's boots." So it's like, I'm sure they weren't Tom Hanks's boots, but Joe was such a great guy, such a great guy.
Oh wow, that's very cool. All
And
right.
yeah, so it was really neat. I got a great tour when we were there. Ivan Schwartz had given us also a great tour of the set, the different sets, because it was filmed at Hatfield, England, at an old base of some sorts. And I'm sure you've heard the stories that the Bastogne scene was all pretty much filmed indoors in an airplane hangar. So that was interesting to get there and to see that and stuff. So
All right. So they finished filming the miniseries and the premiere. You said that everyone was anticipating to find out where's the premiere going to be. I'm assuming you were invited to the premiere.
yeah, well, so how it happened was, all right, so we're all in New Orleans at the banquet on the final night, and Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg come slipping in the side. Now, I just happened to be all the way towards the back of this conference center, next to the bar. I don't even drink, but I was next to the bar. And then they come slipped on in. And so they're standing next to me, and I'm having just a brief conversation with them. And then somebody notices I'm there and they take a picture of me. And then everybody turns around and is like, "Oh, wow, Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg." So they come on the stage and they get up there. And I'm trying to think if it was them that made the announcement or the president of HBO, but said, "Okay, folks, next year on June 6th, 2001.
One.
The world premiere will be on Utah Beach, Normandy, France." And the place erupted. So what they did was, so that was like a year in advance they had to plan the thing. And what they did was they invited all the men. 51 of the guys were there. They were able to get 51 of the guys with the help of Bill Garnier. Bill was very, very helpful in tracking down all of the guys who are coming to reunions, And then there was a lot of guys who, for one reason or another, weren't able to go to reunions. And but anyway, so Bill had provided HBO with all those contacts, and then the widows were all invited as well, and everybody who was invited could bring a guest. But what HBO did was they said, okay, we know your kids or whatever it is may want to come too. If they, come on over the by themselves, here's the hotel we're staying at. They book a room, they take care of it. They will be included in everything that goes on. So that's what we did. So my mother took my oldest brother, and then my Susan and myself and my sister, we all flew over on our own and booked into the hotel. And everything that went on that week, that because we were there, we were included.
Wow.
Whether it was the one night, I think early on, they had a cruise on the River Seine, which was really cool.
So it's a good thing your father
And then
wasn't
they,
there because you said your father doesn't like cruises, that he wouldn't
yeah.
gone.
And then they had four or five different they had four or five different tours that you set up that they have set up. So when you get there, you go and you say, oh yeah, I'll take the half a day Paris tour, I'll take the Versailles tour, I'll take the Giverny tour, I'll take this one. They had all kinds of stuff planned. So you just signed up for these tours and boom, you did all this really cool stuff. And we're at a neat hotel. I think it was the Ambassador Hotel. Neat hotel. All the guys were all over the place. All the actors were there. All the family was there. It was a party. I remember because it's a 6 hour time difference, we were just having fun every night till like 4:30 in the morning. And then, getting up the next day trying to figure out, okay, where I gotta muster the energy to start this again. But yeah, they had all kinds of really cool things planned for us, and it was great. And then on the day of the premiere, we went, they put us on a bus, and we went to Saint-Lazare train station and then went to Carentan. So about 95% of the people as part of this group were on the train, and I think they had one or two buses for some folks to go. By a bus, but everybody was pretty much everybody was on the train, and even Tom Hanks, Spielberg, a lot of the actors, and all that stuff was great. So we had this train ride, and it was really neat to kind of move around and talk to other people and just be with the Easy Company family. And I know my mom had a wonderful time with all of the ladies that because my mom spent all those years. Going to reunions with my dad. So this was her family too. And so it was really cool. And then so we get to Utah Beach. And if you're familiar with Utah Beach, right next to the Roosevelt, I think there's a restaurant there called the Roosevelt, just across the way from the Utah Beach Museum. There's a little spit of land there to the left of that when you're looking out the front door. And HBO had set up two enormous tents, one to house 1,000 people for dinner, and the other one to house 1,000 people as a theater to watch the premiere. And there were 51 guys there directly across from the theater and where the dinner is going to be, in the area where they have their annual event. On June 6th. So there's 51 guys there. It was really great. We all sat there and witnessed the whole thing. And it was just fantastic to see these guys and the recognition that they all got. And, I think even more than that, people always ask me about what my dad's thoughts would be of the whole thing. And I always say, I think my dad would be happy that they focused on their company, but he would hope that all the other kids, sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters would think about their own family history and spend more time and look into that.
Wow, that's great. That's really amazing. You mentioned that you guys were at the premiere, but how do you do a premiere of a 10-part miniseries you're not going to sit there for 10 hours watching it. You know, it's, you know, even though I'm sure you would love to, but, you know.
I know. Spoiler alert, right? Yeah. No, so what they did was they took pretty much the entire episode, a good portion of one, and then they just kind of weaved in some highlights, so to speak, of some of the other episodes, and then they jumped to episode 10, and they kind of finished it off with the final part of it. So it was just a compilation of the episodes squeezed into it, maybe like an hour and a half, possibly.
Oh, wow. Okay. That sounds like such an amazing experience.
And then what they did after that, too, after that was done, when they came back to the U.S., they probably had another six or so premieres within the United States. And beginning in, let's say, like Philadelphia and Florida and Seattle and Los Angeles and New Orleans, and they had these other premieres in each one of the cities, and they would bring in several actors and several of the veterans at each and every one of them. So my wife and I were fortunate enough to go to the Philadelphia event, and then I was able to go to the final U.S. premiere, which was in New Orleans.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. And they pretty much, the premiere always was the same thing. They were showing the same thing.
Okay,
so the miniseries comes out. What did the men think of the finished product?
Well, I think they were all probably pretty proud of the fact that, you know, their story gets told. And naturally, you know, there's a certain amount of creative licensing that goes on. And we had touched on a little bit of that earlier, because if you remember, as I said, you know, about 360 guys went through the unit during World War II, and they couldn't have 360 actors. So what they did was, if there was a certain scene that they wanted to film, for example, one of the scenes in Bastogne, when my dad is in a foxhole with Lipton, and a shell comes in and it doesn't explode. I remember Babe Heffron telling me the story, saying that happened to me. Well, that happened to me too. So I think what was happening was, there were certain scenes where, because there was an A and a B team filming simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So they were on an accelerated pace of all this filming stuff. So maybe Babe Heffron was on the other team, on the B team or the A team, and my dad would just happen to be on that one. So they said, "Hey, Luz, you get in the foxhole," kind of a thing. So it was a little bit of that as well.
Okay, that makes sense.
Hagenau, too, where, you know, one of the guys who was in there, it's a guy named Mercer who actually led that, patrol across the river. But there wasn't a Mercer in the, so they just, I think Johnny Martin played that particular role. So, yeah, it's a little bit of that kind of stuff. I'll tell you, one of the toughest parts for me in this whole thing was the fact that my father had a lot of FaceTime in the series. But not every guy had a lot of FaceTime in the series. And that was the challenging thing for me, was that he was shoulder to shoulder with all of these guys. And he would have gave up his spot so one of his buddies could have got the spot to be on TV. And so, yeah, that was probably one of the tough things for me. There's so many of the guys who didn't really get on the TV, who I knew very well, who were shoulder to shoulder, who talking to those guys and listening and just realizing that he was right there with my dad, and there wasn't enough airtime for everybody.
It's unfortunate. I mean, again, as you mentioned, there are 360 guys. You can't, you know, unfortunately, you can't focus on all of them, you know. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been so fascinating. Is there anything else you feel that you want to bring up about the story, about the men, the miniseries, the book, your father, something that I might have missed?
You'd always just reiterate the point of, My father would want all of the other 16 million American men and women to have their story be told as well. And it begins with people looking into their own history and diving in and finding out a little bit of what their family members did
Okay.
to protect
I
that
think that
freedom.
that sums that up really well.
Good.
You know what? I have one other question.
Sure.
Do you know how the mistake came about Blythe? Do you know the answer to
Yeah, that's, I don't know how it, I referenced that in one of my speeches this week was I don't I you know I don't know why they made that mistake. I just think because I know his son was very disappointed in that. And because I had met his son several times. But I never know exactly where that snafu was created and why it wasn't picked up. But no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. That's, I think if Garnier would a little, if they would have had Garnier closer to the action, I bet he would have picked it up. Yeah, because I think he didn't die until 1967.
Right. I remember that I read about that afterwards.
I talked to his son and several times, and I remember his dad did have a, unfortunately, like a lot of people, had a drinking problem. And he feels as though his dad drank himself to death, But clinically, I'm not quite sure, but that's what his son felt like to me. And but yeah, that's too bad because yeah, he went on to serve with distinction. He was awarded several bronze stars along the way. He was a great soldier, without question. But yeah, I wonder why that. I wonder who missed that one. Yeah, and like I said, I remember the son, man. He was disappointed.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, that's tough.
So George, thank you once again for taking the time to join me and talk to me, and I really appreciate it. I hope to have you back at some time to discuss more things, Band of Brothers wise. So thank you very much.
Well, hey, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Rob. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate you, delving into history the way you have. And, if people want to go to my website, it's just easy, georgeluzzjr.com, and you can learn even more about my dad and the men he served with.
Wow, that's great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So I will be back tomorrow as we start discussing the miniseries itself. But until then, curry!
I don't know if I can say it as good as you say. Curry!